Today is Cinco de Mayo, and Dan Pashman, host of the podcast The Sporkful, has been doing a little thinking about this holiday. He joins us now. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Rachel.
Okay, so Cinco de Mayo. Can you remind us what it was historically and what it has become today?
Well, technically, it commemorates the Battle of Puebla, but you know, it's a pretty small holiday in Mexico. Here in the U.S., it's sort of like a Mexican St. Patrick's Day. It's a celebration of Mexican-American heritage. And in some quarters, it's also just an excuse for a party.
And speaking of a party, of course, that involves a lot of drinking and eating and delicious things like guacamole, which is a personal favorite of mine. You've been doing some in-depth research on this particular subject.
Well, I talked to Lee Frank. He's the co-author of the new book, Ultimate Nachos, From Nachos and Guacamole to Salsas and Cocktails. He says the key to great guacamole is to make it fresh and keep it simple.
All right. So the other key element to guacamole, I think, is the chip. What are the best practices for dipping? Because it can be kind of a dangerous game. I mean, chips are fragile things. They break.
They sure do. I talked to Isaac Gates. He's a structural engineer in Chicago, and he addressed a timeless concern. You know, when you're working with standard triangular chips, you can either hold one point and dip 2 points, or you can hold a straight edge and dip 1 point. Now, it's tempting to dip 2 points, I know, because that gives you a wider berth for the dip. But Isaac says don't do it. That puts too much strain on the chip, and it makes it break. He also says that instead of flat triangles, you should look for ones with a bending, undulating shape.
So it's kind of like a dome shape, because a natural, like very strong shape in compression is an arch, and then a 3D arch is a dome. All the elements are able to take that load, work together, and kind of just keep pushing all the way down to wherever they're supported.
All right, so that's the challenge of the flat chip. What about the scoop chip?
I like them. They're not perfect, but I appreciate the attempt at innovation. What do you think?
Yeah, I think they're a complete disgrace. I mean, this is for total amateurs who are not willing to brave the fragility of the chip-in-dip moment.
Well, we're learning a lot about you here, Rachel. But I would argue that you're arguing now against societal progress. I mean, why should we get messy if we have the technology to stay clean? Plus, you just heard our engineer say that domes are really strong. And what is a scoop but an upside-down dome?
Whoa.
That's right. So I present to you now my new It's Not a Scoop, It's a Dome technique for chip and guacamole consumption. All right? Take the scoop chip, put it on the tip of your pointer finger upside down like a thimble. Brace it with your thumb, run it through all the guac you desire, and it will not break.
Dan Pashman, he's the host of the Sporkful podcast. Hey, Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Rachel.
This is NPR News.
The Kentucky Derby is tomorrow, and it is as much about pageantry and food as it is about the races. The Derby was a big reason why Chef Edward Lee fell in love with Kentucky. The top chef, trained in kitchens all over France. He owned a restaurant in Manhattan that attracted plenty of celebrities. But then at age 27, he started to take these road trips all across the country.
Wound up through a friend of a friend and said, hey, you got to go to Derby. And I thought, of course I do.
Of course you do.
I have to wear seersucker and drink bourbon and wear a hat. It just felt like a great party and a great atmosphere.
And 10 years later, Lee is still there. He owns a couple of restaurants in Louisville and is just out with a new cookbook called Smoke and Pickles. Before all of that, as a Korean-American kid growing up in Brooklyn, Edward Lee learned to love a huge range of flavors and cultures and all the ways they could mix together.
My parents deliberately, when they immigrated to America, decided that they weren't going to live in the big Korean enclaves, that they wanted to sort of spread out and be amongst other people.
To expose you to other cultures?
Yeah, to expose and just to be American, which I thought was pretty forward-thinking. I probably didn't realize or appreciate it at the time, but I mean, I was surrounded by Jamaicans and Indian cuisine and Iranian cuisine and Jewish cuisine. And
what a mix.
Yeah, and a lot of these people just became, you know, our default babysitters. Or, you know, they would be neighbors and they would come by and drop off food and we'd hang out and I would go to their house. You know, it's just we experienced it really from a home kitchen, not from a restaurant side.
So many flavors. It sounds really cool.
Yeah, I grew up watching my grandmother cook, and I would hang out with her in the kitchen, And she knew I was watching her, and she would just continue. And she would ignore me for hours. She would just tell me, like, get out of here, I'm busy. But she knew I was watching, and I would little by little just start helping her with things. And it was very funny, too, because from a very patriarchal society that Korean culture is, it's the daughter that does that. My sister, God bless her, I love her, but, you know, she can't cook, you know, a thing of ramen.
If she hears this, she won't be offended, right?
No, she knows that. She's happy to eat out at restaurants. And she was kind of the wild child, and I was the one. I was like, I'm not going anywhere. I live here. I'm gonna watch you cook, and I'm going to steal your secrets. She put a lot of thought and effort and meaning into everything she did. And there was a lot of it that she rejected some of the things of her past because to her it represented poverty. You know, it's like to cook rice on a stovetop was something that poor people did, because now, look at me, I've got an electric Japanese rice maker. Huh. And with the touch of a button, I can make rice in 20 minutes.
She preferred sometimes to use the rice cooker because it was a statement about that I'm not in poverty. I can afford a rice cooker.
Exactly, yeah.
You grow up, you get this great career, and you open a Korean barbecue restaurant in the middle of Manhattan. Why is that not where you decided to stay? Why did you not feel like, you know, I've made it, this is great?
It was an okay restaurant. I'm not going to lie. It was decent.
It was all right. It was okay.
You know, everything seemed right on paper. You know, Korean kid opens Korean restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
But it just didn't feel right. And I wasn't incredibly proud of the food. I felt like it was just kind of an extension of what I thought people wanted me to cook.
And so that brings us to Kentucky. Tell me how you blend Southern comfort food and you know, Korean food and Korean spices. What's the key?
To me, it's just very instinctual. I didn't know much about Southern food when I first moved to Louisville, but obviously the more I lived here, the more I traveled, the more I met farmers, and the more I met these crazy people that grew these crazy things here, I thought, wow, this is amazing. And I love because Southern food tends to be a little bit on the sweeter side. Asian food tends to be a little bit on the saltier kind of umami side.
Mm-hmm.
And when they work and you put them together, they actually are a wonderful marriage.
Kimchi, pickling cabbage, sort of
a fermented cabbage pickle.
Where do we see kimchi meeting Southern food in your book?
Kimchi is really a verb. You kimchi things. You can kimchi cabbage.
Ah.
You can make kimchi out of oysters, cucumbers, radishes.
I can kimchi oysters?
You can kimchi oysters. But all you're doing is taking raw oysters, putting it into a brine, and then letting it ferment.
Okay.
And cure. So, I mean, you can kimchi pretty much anything.
I'm very curious because you said you've traveled around the farms of Kentucky and you've seen some crazy things. What's the craziest?
I remember the first time that I heard the word sorghum.
Sorghum.
So sorghum is very much like a cane sugar.
Okay.
It almost looks like bamboo, and you chop it down, and then you boil it down to make something that resembles honey, but is a lot darker, deeper, richer, has more flavor.
Huh. And you use that in a lot of your cooking?
Pretty much the day I discovered sorghum, I said, we are never using honey again.
Aha. Uh-huh.
When I first got here 10 years ago, there was still this fascination with European cuisine, and, you know, you would go to a restaurant, and they'd have, we have wildflower truffle honey from Alba, and you know, it was so delicious. But I remember driving through a roadside stand and saw this old farmer in dungarees, and she had this thing called sorghum in a jar. And I remember I said, sorghum, I said, isn't that like, you know, feed for animals? And she said, well, that's sorghum crop. This is sorghum plant. And she explained the whole thing to me. And I remember thinking, why are we buying honey from 1,000 miles in another continent?
Yeah.
When you have this incredible indigenous product not 30 miles away from my restaurant, and these incredible people who have spent their life and their parents' lives and their grandparents' lives and their great-grandparents' lives growing this crop in a farm in Winchester, Kentucky. And I thought, this is incredible. This is what agriculture is all about.
Before we go, I can't leave you without mentioning the Kentucky Derby one more time, because there are a lot of good Kentucky Derby drinks in this cookbook.
Yes, there are. We love the cocktails. I keep the cocktails very simple because for the very simple fact that a good bourbon is good on its own with maybe a cube of ice and a little bit of water.
Mm-hmm.
But if you must, during the celebration season, everyone likes to have a little flourish on their cocktail. So we do have some fun cocktails like the jalapeno mint julep, which is a drink that bites you back a little bit.
Edward Lee, this has been so much fun. We really appreciate the time.
Thank you. I enjoyed being on.
Edward Lee's new cookbook is called Smoke and Pickles, and if you want to make that jalapeno mint julep for the Derby tomorrow, you can find the recipe at our website, npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene. Health officials are hoping that we are not seeing the early signs of a global pandemic. For now, the focus is on China, where a new bird flu strain has emerged. It's known as H7N9. A new death is being reported there this morning, bringing the death toll in this current outbreak to 32. Many of those deaths have occurred in China's second largest city, Shanghai. And that's where we began our coverage with NPR's Frank Langfitt. He found residents who seem to be taking the outbreak in stride.
Every morning here at Shangming High School, there's a nurse named Zhang Hong. She stands at the gate in a white lab coat, and she watches the students come in. Students, a lot of them are wearing track suits. It's kind of like a school uniform, and many of them are dragging big roll bags full of books.
If a student feels uncomfortable, we give them a checkup. If their temperature is over 100, we take them to the hospital to see a doctor.
Zhang says she finds two or three students a day with temperatures, but so far none with the virus. And she's not that worried about it.
This time around, the bird flu is not very infectious, and it's not as serious as SARS.
SARS, or severe acute respiratory syndrome, struck South China in late 2002. It eventually infected more than 8,000 people in 32 countries and killed more than 700 worldwide. So far, H7N9 has only infected about 130 people, mostly just here in China. But it could turn out to be much more lethal. At the moment, its death rate is twice that of SARS. Scientists found H7N9 in birds in outdoor markets. Shanghai responded by shutting down live poultry sales and killing more than 100,000 chickens, ducks, and other fowl. Even in this apartment complex where I'm standing right now, managers have penned off a group of black swans on the off chance they become infected. Some restaurants have stopped serving chicken, but people continue to eat it. At a KFC on Nanjing Road, Shanghai's main shopping street, tables are jammed at lunchtime. A man named Yang, who works for a computer chip maker, considers his New Orleans chicken burger.
I'm not worried. It's common knowledge that the virus will be killed under high temperature. So judging by existing reports, it's safe to eat chicken.
Out on the street, Zhang, a 40-year-old office administrator, wears a surgical mask and has sworn off chicken. But she says officials have responded better to this virus than they did to SARS.
It seemed only after SARS had already spread all around the country that the government started to take some action. Now, Shanghai's response is fairly quick. After a few cases were discovered, a news conference was held.
And not everyone is satisfied. Last week, the daughter of a couple infected by H7N9 crashed a press conference to question officials about her father's treatment. She hadn't seen her dad in nearly a month. Officials escorted her out before she could address them. The worry now is H7N9 might adapt and spread easily from person to person. Leo Poon, a virologist at the University of Hong Kong, says the virus already has a couple of key mutations.
These two are quite important, and that may hint that the virus is trying to adapt into humans. I mean, like colleagues in all over the world who work with influenza virus, they're all very concerned about it. Of course, we hope that this will not be another possibility of having a pandemic, but then who knows?
Back at the KFC, Wang Chao, a recent college grad, says he's cut back on his chicken eating. And as long as the virus only spreads from birds to people, he's not too concerned. Human-to-human transmission would be a different story. If that really happens, he says, I would be really worried. And so would everyone else. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Shanghai.
Almost a third of the country's honeybee colonies did not make it through the winter. That's according to a new survey of America's beekeepers. In fact, that's been the case almost every year for the past 6 years. Beekeepers say unless someone can help more bees survive, there won't be enough to pollinate America's apples, blueberries, and other treasured crops. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture began this annual nationwide survey 6 years ago after beekeepers reported some new and frightening problems with their bees.
Well, we started out literally by phoning beekeepers.
That's Jeffrey Pettis, who's in charge of the USDA's Bee Research Laboratory in Beltsville, Maryland. Over the past 6 years, on average, 30% of all the honeybee colonies in the U.S. died off over the winter. The worst year was 5 years ago. Last year was the best. Just 22% of the colonies died.
Last year gave us some hope. The bees were doing, honeybees were doing better.
But this year, the death rate was up again, 31%. When the survey started, beekeepers talked a lot about colony collapse disorder, colonies that seemed pretty healthy but suddenly collapsed. The bees flew away and didn't come back. Beekeepers are not seeing that so much anymore, Pettis says. They're mostly seeing colonies that just dwindle. As the crowd of bees gets smaller, it gets weaker.
They can't generate heat very well in the spring to rear brood. They can't also generate heat to fly.
Farmers who grow crops like almonds and blueberries and apples rely on commercial beekeepers to make sure their crops get pollinated. This year, Pettis says, we came closer than ever before to a real crisis. The only thing that saved part of the almond crop in California was some lovely weather.
But we got incredibly good flight weather. So the bees, even those small colonies that we talked about earlier, the small colonies that can't fly very well in cool weather, they were able to fly because of good weather.
And the bees reached every tree. Pettis says beekeepers can really only afford to lose about 15% of their colonies each year. More than that, and they lose money. Some commercial beekeepers are still in business, he says, just because they love it.
I mean, it's just something that gets in your blood, so you don't want to give up. You know, okay, it's 30% loss this year. I'll do better next year. We're very much optimists.
Beekeepers have a whole list of reasons why so many colonies are dying. There's a nasty parasite called the varroa mite, which they can't get rid of. Also, bee-killing pesticides. And they say there are just fewer places in the country where a bee can find plenty of food, plenty of flowering plants that provide nectar and pollen. That was especially true this past year. The same drought that left Midwestern cornfields parched and wilting also dried up wildflowers and starved the bees. That was a natural disaster. But May Berenbaum, a professor of entomology at the University of Illinois, says most of the changes in the landscape are the result of people's decisions about what to do with their land.
I just wish there were more incentives for more people, not just farmers, to plant a more diversified landscape that provides nutritional resources for all kinds of pollinators.
So plant more flowers.
Plant more flowers and be a little more tolerant of the weeds in the garden.
What's more controversial is the role of pesticides. Some beekeepers and environmentalists are calling for tighter restrictions on the use of one particular class of pesticides called neonicotinoids. Europe is about to ban some uses of these pesticides, but U.S. farmers and pesticide companies are opposed to any such move here. And the Environmental Protection Agency says it's not yet convinced that this would help the bees very much. Dan Charles, NPR News.
It may mean little in the overall picture of bee health, but there are many backyards and rooftops around the U.S. with a hive or two, including here at NPR's new building in Washington, D.C. Our so-called green roof, covered with soil and plants, as of yesterday, houses two small wooden hives with over 20,000 bees. No honey yet, but the bees have inspired an unofficial Twitter feed, at NPR Bees.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.